Welcome back to the second part of our interview. Yesterday we were fortunate enough to have His Holiness Dr. Chaitanya Swami do an interview with us. Today, Chinmay is so welcome and there's so much nice things that Maharaj can share with us. We decided to continue this. Did you have a good day so far, Maharaj?
Yes, thank you. Very good.
Yesterday we touched on a little bit of food and the concept of the festival. Today I was thinking in mind of a lot of people have questions that usually they don't get answered. Like, why do bad things happen to good people?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. Did any of you ever think of that?
Yes.
Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? Sometimes, not all the time. Why does anything happen to anyone? Why? I mean, does it just happen or what? So yeah, that's a good question, thank you. So anyway, let me just briefly get into the subject. If we assume there is only one lifetime, this one, and there was no lifetime before in which we could have earned something which we might get in this lifetime, but you know, we were nothing before, perhaps we didn't even exist, but then we were born and we came into existence. And, you know, now we've been living so many years. But, you know, you take a person. Some people are apparently very nice, basically very nice. But then suddenly their lives are turned upside down. If there's only this lifetime, and if God is there, and God sees that people get what they deserve, you know, if the situation is like that, then how could a person who is essentially nice and not really done anything terrible, how could their life somehow become a disaster and you know, maybe fall to pieces altogether? Or even if you take it a step further, consider this. How about, you know, if there is a God, and He is in charge, and He's managing things in the right way, but we only have this one lifetime, how is it that a child in the womb of the mother can be aborted? They didn't even have the opportunity to do anything there. But they're killed. And, you know, that's sort of about the worst thing that can happen to you, probably, if you're killed. If there's only one life, and they had no opportunity to do anything for which the natural reaction might be that they should be killed, then how come the child in the womb is killed and aborted? You know, maybe the worst thing the child in the womb did was kick the mother a few times. But that's not very serious. So anyway, this is a good question, and people have written books about it. There's actually one Jewish rabbi, it was about 30 years ago, or 25 years ago perhaps, Harold Kirschner. He wrote a book titled like this, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? And he tried to offer an explanation. Just try and listen to this. It's, you know, fractionally technical, but if you listen, you know, I'm sure you'll get it. His idea, his theory is, God is good. In the beginning, God God made the creation very nicely. And of course, God is good, but he's also very intelligent. So in the beginning, he made everything very nicely. And only good things were happening to good people. And the bad things were all happening to the bad people. And it wasn't, you know, going in the other ways. But Krishna, his theory is that God lost control. So still, he's very nuts. He doesn't want that bad things happen to good people, or good things to bad people, perhaps, or whatever. All these apparent anomalies. But he lost control. So now bad things happen to good people, and there's God like, wow, blew it, couldn't handle it, dropped the ball. So that's his theory. Now, of course, you know, it's just a theory, obviously. In a sense, it is nicer than the alternative. What is the alternative? That God is intelligent enough. He could see that good things happen to good people and bad things to bad people, but now he just doesn't care. In other words, he's no longer such a nice guy. And if you're a Mr. Nice Guy, and suddenly your life falls to pieces somehow, then he could stop it and see that everything gets back into place, but he just sits back and laughs at you. That's the kind of, you know, turning it around the other way. So in Krishna consciousness, we don't accept either perspective. Okay. So let me just very briefly tell you the way we see things. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, we are all eternal persons. These bodies are just vehicles. I have a male body, now you have a female body. I'm European, you're Indian. I'm a certain age, you're a certain age. People identify in these terms that this is me, this is you, this is who we are. But actually, as I said in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, we are eternal persons. We are not these bodies, they're just vehicles. But now we're identifying with the vehicle. Just like, you know, I'm sure some of you here are successful business people. Now you're driving in a nice Mercedes-Benz, something like that. And people see you driving around down the road in your nice motor car, they think, oh, okay, there he is, successful man, very good. But when you were young, when you got your first car, maybe it was an old Toyota. It was already, you know, 20 years old or 10 years old and a bit rickety. And people would see you, you know, driving down the road, and they think, who's this fool in this stupid old car? But now they see you, the same person in the Rolls Royce. Yesterday I saw someone in a Bentley, and I used to road test motor cars for newspapers, by the way, in the distant past. So I know. Anyway, I have some idea about motor cars. So, you know, someone is in a Bentley. And anyone who knows anything about motor cars sees someone in a Bentley and thinks, wow,
nice car.
This guy must be cool. But before, he's the same person. A few years ago, they thought he was stupid for driving in some silly old car. But he's the same person, not another person. It's the vehicle which has changed. People are evaluating in terms of the vehicle. All these external considerations. So, yeah, and we change cars, isn't it, during the course of our life? Nobody, no normal driver keeps the same car from, you know, when they're 20 years old till they're 60 years old. It doesn't happen. they go through a few cars because the cars wear out before we do. So this is just to illustrate the principle. We are eternal persons. We live on. The body becomes useless. We get another one. We don't walk into the shop and buy another one. But in terms of our activities, we're given another body. And all the activities we perform, they all have, you could say, some value. Positive, negative, some of them are mixed, both positive and negative. Some are very positive, some are very negative. And God is not stupid. So you do something, and you get the appropriate reaction. It may not be tomorrow. It may be in your next lifetime. And therefore, a person who in many ways is nice, but some reaction catches up with them in the next lifetime, and all of a sudden, bang, you know, maybe they're like Mrs. Bhutto, right? Assassinated out of the blue. Everyone thought, well, many people thought she was going to become the president of Pakistan. Big, important position. Now she's wiped out. Just like that. The Shah of Iran. Our devotees in Iran in those days were teaching his family yoga. Yeah. And knew him quite well. Suddenly was the revolution. He was booted out. So this is all in terms of our previous activities. And in many cases from the previous lifetime, and not just in this lifetime. Let me just touch on one little point, interesting little point. When I first joined our movement in London, January 1973, the Beatles were somewhat involved. George Harrison was very involved. The others were somewhat involved. Ringo Starr was somewhat involved. Paul McCartney, John Lennon, to a limited degree. But he was there somewhere. And our devotees would see them quite regularly. So, John Lennon, under the influence of Yoko Ono, he started to sort of reject the Krishna conscious concepts. And one of the things he started to reject was karma. This idea that you get a reaction for an action. If you know his song, Imagine, this kind of expresses a lot of it. So John Lennon, one of our devotees was with him. They were in some sort of cafe, coffee bar sort of place. And they were discussing these things. But it became, you know, maybe not an argument, but a little bit of a strong discussion. That, you know, yes, karma. The devotee was saying, John Lennon was saying, no, no, no. Just this one lifetime. Went back and forth for a while, then John Lennon had to leave. So he stood up. He forgot that when he was sitting, over the top there was a beam that was like an old sort of Tudor Elizabethan old building with exposed beams. There was a beam sticking out over his head. When he sat down, he negotiated his way underneath it and sat down. When he stood up, he was feeling a little excited after the discussion. He forgot about it. He stood up and bang, hit his head and sat down, a bit shaken. The next day, he wrote the song, Instant Karma. Now, some of you who are sort of from my era or thereabouts, you may know that song. Instant karma is going to catch you. It will hit you over the head. You better get yourself together because tomorrow you may be dead. We're not worshiping John Henry. But it's interesting.
Would that also be the explanation for the amount of suffering we have in the world? Considering God is all loving, all good, nothing is usually bad, but yet we face so much suffering.
Right. This is the explanation, yeah. That, you know, just imagine Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin. Now, these were extremely heavy people. So, you know, they made the National Party look like nice guys. Anyway, we don't want to get political about it, but they're super-duper heavy people, slaughterers of humankind. So, Adolf died, and he's born in his next lifetime. And you know, there's now little baby Adolf. Would it be surprising if something went wrong in his life? If he encountered a few problems? In terms of karma, getting reactions for things you've done, would it be surprising? But you look at little Adolf, and you may think, oh, what a sweet little boy. They all look sweet, don't they? Particularly to their mothers. What a sweet little boy! How could this... And then, you know, maybe suddenly he's killed very violently. It happens to children. Yeah, it happens to people sometimes. Suddenly they're squashed by a truck or something. Or mercilessly killed even a little baby. And of course it's very sad. Now this would be the explanation for how these things happen. It's all coming. Not all coming, but a certain amount is coming from previous activities in previous lifetimes. But it all catches up. They say, I think it's a Christian saying, the wheels of God grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly fine. Means like in a sort of mechanical grain grinding machine. I think it's a Christian saying. So it's like that. He is no fool. We may do stupid things and think, oh, why did I do that from time to time? He doesn't.
Okay, that's fair enough. Now, generally in life, not everyone is Hare Krishna, not yet. but generally, what I'd like, imagine, I have a friend who's a devotee, practicing in the ways, following a Krishna conscious life. She's married to someone who's not a devotee.
Okay.
Now, that can, well, that can tend to be a problem, you know, because it's two completely different lifestyles. Is it possible to be able to manage both?
Okay. That's a good question. It's a practical question. Yeah. Everyone's an individual. And people change, like, you know, some people, they're already married, but then one of them, some years later, they have contact with Krishna consciousness, and then they, you know, it just really, really strikes them very deeply, and then they feel, you know, I must get into this, I really want to get into it. But the other one's got no interest. You know, it's not just a matter of Krishna consciousness and something else. But we're just talking about people. And during the course of people's lives, it happens. Sometimes they develop different interests. Just happens. But the other person doesn't get into that thing. Their partner. So what to do? Anyway, you know, sometimes they say life is a process of negotiation. You never get, even in the best couple, the most compatible. They're just, you know, really, they really fit into each other like a hand in a glove, like a very natural relationship. But still, over a period of time, as they get to know each other more and more and more, then they see that they have their little quirks and other interests, and so there has to be some negotiation, some discussion. And the thing is that there are, talking about Krishna consciousness specifically, in a marriage where the partner is not, you know, there are many marriages in which one of them is a devotee, the other is not. But if the one who is a devotee, first of all, the one who is a devotee, if they don't try to just like impose and force that, you know, you must be Krishna conscious, otherwise I'm going to divorce you. And then the other one, if they're also broad-minded enough, broad-minded you could say, or you could also say, if they're really actually interested in the well-being and the happiness of their partner, and they see that actually my partner is really getting something out of this, even though I'm not, then as long as it doesn't, you know, fundamentally threaten the relationship between the two of them, if they're sensitive enough like that, they should be able to make some balance. And in fact, we find it happens, yeah, that the one who's a devotee, they can practice their Krishna consciousness and their responsibilities in the relationship in their own way, and the other one is able to adjust, and they can both adjust to each other without it having to be a confrontation of, you know, either my way or the highway type of situation. You know, it takes some maturity on the parts of both, and it takes, well, you could say it takes love. When we say love, we mean something a little different from what many people refer to as love. What a lot of people refer to as love means something to the effect that you give pleasure to me. You know, I get a lot out of you, and therefore I'm very attached to you. And you may get a lot out of me, therefore you become attached to me, therefore we come together and we stick together. But then later, if I or you meet another person who seems that they're going to give whoever more than the other one, then there's divorce, or they break up. So this type of feeling, this type of attraction, is not what we call love. What I was referring to a minute or two ago is more what we refer to as love. That is a genuine concern and interest for the well-being and the happiness of the other, of the partner, and not just what's in it for me. This what's in it for me, we call lust. Basically, it's lust. It's not really love. Love means like that. And pure love means completely selfless. Willing to do whatever, anything. There may be practically, actually no limit to what we're prepared to do for the beloved. Generally, this is only there in a relationship with God. Generally. Actually, Prabhupada, our spiritual master, said, the closest thing to love, to that pure love, in the material world, in material relationships, the closest thing is the love of a mother for a child. Not in all cases, because the mothers, you know, usually they're the ones who got the abortions. And one of my friends, he's now, you know, the same age as me, well into his mid-50s and beyond. He was telling me, on his 21st birthday, his mother's mother, his maternal grandmother, told him, said, you know, I've got something I have to tell you. She said, when my daughter, your mother, was pregnant with you, she wanted to have you aborted, but I talked her out of it. Well, it's, you know, his perspective on his mother changed.
Okay. Getting back to topic of discussion, say you start a new job, and as a devotee, you go into the workforce, in the workplace, and generally devotees have a seeker, you know, and people look at you. How would you, maybe in the most concise manner, explain to them what you're about?
She is implying I'm not being concise. I'm trying to give the topics the importance they deserve. But anyway, it's okay. It's all right. So, okay. Well, you know, it depends. Like, you know, to just say it's like this, you must do that and not do this, you can't really do it. It depends. In some work situations, if you're a devotee, you should go undercover. Because sometimes some people become prejudiced against devotees. You know, this is in religion. Anyway, prejudice. Here in South Africa, we know all about prejudice. So, it depends on the circumstances. But one should only really go undercover and hide the fact that one is a devotee if there's real prejudice which may threaten one's position and one's job. I mean, of course, you can always get another job or try, but you may not be able to. Then, you know, another possibility is another perspective, being extremely concise. Another perspective would be that in many situations, like if you work for the government, I know a few devotees, they go to work dressed essentially like I am, with tilak, with sika, we call this a sika by the way, with shaved head. I know one devotee, he was in Bisho. He was reporting directly to the premier of the East Cape, yeah, directly, every day, in his immediate team. But because the government, by law, you're not allowed to fire people for, you know, these religious things and all that. So he was going just like this, to work, every day. Anyway, then they offered him a better post in Pretoria, and he's there now. And he's like, you know, one of the big directors. And he goes to work just basically like this. Yeah, and they accept it. Yeah, you know, a lot of people in South Africa are not as narrow-minded as a lot of people used to be. If you go, yeah, like if you go to New York, you walk down the streets dressed like this, people think you're conservative. You get all these people in Superman outfits, Batman. I tell you what, it gets pretty way out. So it depends. You should see. You should see. But you should only, if you're a devotee and you really enjoy your life in Krishna consciousness, Don't hide it. Don't hide it. There's no need and it will not help. But in some situations it may. So you just see. And maybe Prabhupada would say, in a sensitive situation, in like a needle, out like a cloud. So you can go into a new job, like Mr. or Miss or Mrs. anybody, totally like, anybody else, and just feel out the situation, and then gradually more and more show your Krishna consciousness, and then if they don't mind, then you can be pretty open about it, but don't try and force it on people. If you want to upset, if you want to turn people against something you're into, try and force it on them.
Yeah, sure.
They say, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Yeah. So in Krishna consciousness, we try not to force things on people, because even if they superficially accept, shortly after they'll reject because it hasn't gone very deep.
Okay.
Those are some concise thoughts.
In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, always remember me and never forget me. That's pretty difficult in today's world. We've bombarded with so many other things. Yes, it's superficial, but they're there nonetheless. So how is that possible? Or how can you make that happen?
Okay. Well, that's also a very good question for those who may be devotees or trying to be or might like to be. Yeah, how are we going to think of Krishna always? Well, in order to think of Krishna always, you have to have something to think about him. You have to know something about him. Otherwise, how are you going to think about him? If I tell you there's a person, like I go to Russia regularly, Siberia. There is someone in Siberia. His name is John. I want you to think about him, okay? It's going to be very difficult to think about him because you don't know anything about him to think about. So similarly with Krishna. If we are to think of Krishna, we have to know something about him. How are we going to find something out about him? We have to read the books. And there's a lot of pastimes, different things Krishna has done. Then Krishna has expressed his feelings and his thoughts on different subjects. That information is there. In this way we can think about Krishna. If we learn about him, like at school, if you want to pass the exam, it means you have to be able to think about the things correctly. Then you have to study the stuff. And then you can think about the stuff sufficiently to answer the questions and pass. So similarly, to think about Krishna, we have to do like that. That's one thing. Then the second thing is, if we do something for Krishna, if you do something for a person, as like a specific service for that person, the tendency is to think of the person as you do it. Yeah. So, if we have some service to do for Krishna, that will help us also to think of Krishna and remember him. When we think, what am I doing? Oh yeah, I'm doing it for Krishna.
Now, last thing I'm curious to know is, whenever you see Hare Krishna people, they're chanting and dancing. Generally, well, there are people out there that don't look at that way as praise. You know, they do it more quietly and peacefully. We can rock the house sometimes, can you maybe tell me what the significance of it?
Rock every street. Sequence. It needs to be rocked. Okay. Okay. Like you may have noticed, I have my hand in my bead bag here. This is a bag we have beads in it. And, a very creative name. It is called a bead bag. So, George Harrison told me one time, George Harrison told me one time. He was walking around all over the place chanting on his beads. And he said, you know, he was such a famous person. So many people would speak to him or want to speak to him. And he said, many people would ask him, what's this? And he said he would try to explain, well, these are my beads, it's a type of meditation, and this and that, it'll take 5 minutes. And he didn't have the time. So he told me, he ended up telling people, I hurt my hand, therefore I'm keeping it in here. It's sort of like a bandage, sort of. Anyway. So my point in bringing that up, to be concise, is that there are other forms of Kriya in Krishna consciousness other than chant, you know, jumping up while singing and all that. Yeah, we do different things. We chant on the beads. And we also chant within our minds, silent meditation. There are different things we do. But, the thing is, when we do these prayers or sing these songs in glorification of Krishna, then he is personally present in the sound vibration. And we have contact with him. That contact with the Lord is very enlivening. Therefore the devotee spontaneously feels like dancing often when they're, particularly when they're singing and really putting everything into it. So as a result, they dance. And it's a natural expression of natural happiness. But also in another type of situation, then they may sit quietly and chant, and become more internal about it, go more deeply within. So in Krishna consciousness, you find all these different practices and different types of experiences. It's very profound, actually. You should give it a try. Anyway, she's a devotee. It's okay. I'm joking.
Thank you.